Thanks. Yeah, if you guys could have an off week next week, that'd help us out a lot. I talk to a lot of groups. It's a pleasure to be here. And what I try to do in the interest of your time is to tell you a few things that you might not have heard or that will maybe help you think about the world when you leave. You know, try to make this 45 minutes or whatever somewhat worthwhile for you as well as me, because, you know, you can listen to different economists all day. I've worked as a top-down macro guy, you know, forecasting country models, you know, different stocks and bonds and different markets and sectors and styles, value versus growth, small versus large. And I've also worked as a bottom-up, as a portfolio consultant using discounted cash flow models, I think the best in the world, advising clients on which stocks are overvalued or undervalued or which ones are well-managed or not. And then at Credit Suisse, I was a strategist combining the top-down with the bottom-up, so to speak. That always sounds a lot better than it is in practice. And I can tell you, the longer I'm at this, the less enthusiasm I have for a lot of this sort of, you know, being smarter than the market. On our website at South Texas Money Management, and this is all I'll say about that, I have a quote from Paul Samuelson, you know, a Nobel Prize winner, and he said, people should spend less time trying to outsmart the markets and more time trying to use the markets through diversification. And that's kind of what we do at South Texas Money Management. And so what I tell you, I set the macro course for our firm. I try to provide a rudder. But it's never, you never want to rely on a macro guru. I'm a big fan of process over guru. You know, the goal to meeting all your clients' goals is to come up with a decent investment plan and stay with it. And I think, as we all know, coming up with a decent investment plan isn't really the hard part. It's the staying with it that is. So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to start with just a quick framework. In my experience as a professional economist, what has helped me? You know, I've worked through all the macro models. I've been down so many roads and dead ends. And there's just a handful of things that have been really useful. And I want to share those with you because I think they'll be useful with you. The presentation could just be as well be called Shocks and Stocks, because I kind of take a macroeconomic shock view of the world. And so we're going to do a quick one-on-one and then look at some different shocks. And I always start my talks by saying, you know, the most important thing I can leave you, framework for understanding the world in the simplest way possible, was put forth by an economist named Milton Friedman. Now, when I was a kid, Friedman was a household name. I mean, you either loved him or hated him. But the truth is, Friedman published on the U.S. business cycle and economy in peer-reviewed journals for 7 decades. I mean, his first article in the 30s was a review of Wesley Clair Mitchell's business cycle analysis. And then on his death, after his death in 06, they published an article on the same macroeconomic phenomena. So Friedman, at the end of his life, was asked, you know, what do you think of the U.S. business cycle? And what he said was kind of shocking. He said, you know, I don't think there is such a thing really as a business cycle, okay? So what Friedman said was, if you want to understand the U.S. economy, think of it like a piece of string glued to the underside of a board that's slanted upwards. And that string is plucked down from time to time. And those plucks are different macroeconomic shocks like wars, oil price hikes, the near collapse of the global financial system. Once these shocks are removed through hopefully a suitable policy response, the economy resumes its upward trend. So if you look at 150 years of data and, you know, Robert Lucas, Friedman, anybody who's won a Nobel Prize has this chart in their presentation, the U.S. economy tends to grow at about 3% per year on average. Sometimes it gets hit by shocks all the time. If the shocks are severe enough, it dislocates things such that you get a negative GDP growth from quarter to quarter for a couple quarters, which is a recession. Usually when the shock is removed, the upward trend resumes. So there's no need for, to ask what's going to be the catalyst to get the economy going, because the catalyst never leaves. People in the U.S., they want stuff and they have to work to get it, and it just gets dislocated from time to time. That's the right way to think about it. This violates all PowerPoint presentations, but this is from the National Bureau of Economic Research. That fourth column to the right, the numbers, that shows the length in months of every economic expansion since we've got data, going back to the 1850s. And these are the facts of the U.S. economy. Expansions can be anywhere from 12 months to 10 years, okay? So the notion of the baseball analogy, well, I think we're in the fifth inning of this one, is invalid when applied to the U.S. economy. You have an expansion, and it'll go until you get a big enough shock to where it dislocates things, right? So it can be 12 months, it can be 10 years. Double dips, the head of the NBER says we've never really had one. We had two back-to-back recessions in the early 80s when the Fed engaged in a one-off monetary experiment that it never did again. But even Robert Gordon, who's the head of the Business Cycle Dating Committee, said that was really one big one. But when somebody says, I think we're going to have a recession next year, what they're telling you is they expect a big shock next year, or we've already suffered a shock that's severe enough that it's going to lead to negative GDP growth down the road. But that's the way to think about the U.S. economy. That's also the best way to think about the stock market. And I've been around the block on this stuff with Kondratieff waves and this notion that, you know, we're in a mini bull market and a secular bear market. All these things that, in my opinion, and remember, this is just this economist's opinion, have no analytical validity whatsoever. If you look at the stock market, and this is just, chart off of going from the 40s, tends to trend upwards because the U.S. economy grows at about 3% per year. But then it gets dislocated frequently by frequent shocks. Now, if you look at the right-hand part of this chart, it's very important. A lot of analysts will zero in on that, and they'll say, well, stocks are, you know, they're back to overvalued. What you see, though, if you really want to understand the stock market, or they'll say, well, we've been in a 10-year secular bear market. You have an upward trend, and then, boom, you have a big shock, which in this case was the tech bust in 9/11. Markets go down. Then they start trending up at the end, and then, boom, another big shock, the near collapse of the global financial system, stocks go down. Then they start to trend back up again. So the shock-based view of the economy, if it's correct, should also kind of explain general patterns in the stock market, and it does. I know that's simple, but in my opinion, you don't have to get any more complex than that. I promise you I've worked with the most complex models in the world for valuing the overall stock market as far as removing accounting distortions at Credit Suisse. And the way I think about the market is pretty simple. You know, the market tends to, investors in the aggregate set the price of stocks such that the return to owning them is commensurate with the risk of stocks, which long term, as we all know, is somewhere around 9% per year, depending on when you start. So when people ask me, what do you think stocks are going to do over the next 12 months? My answer is always, well, 9%. If the number of shocks that you or I don't know about over the next 12 months are more negative than positive, then it's going to be less than 9%. If the number of shocks that happen over the next 12 months that neither you nor I know about right now are more positive than negative, then it's going to be greater than 9%. That has steered me more correctly than all the research and analysis in the world. I'm embarrassed by most quants when they get, my age. You know, when you're 50 and north of that, you have far less enthusiasm for a lot of that than when you're 30. Some other quick facts in the U.S. economy. People don't realize that this comes from the textbook of Edward Lehmer at UCLA, the UCLA Anderson School of Forecasting. Lehmer's kind of the guru of econometrics, and if you're a graduate student in economics, you're required to read Lehmer's paper, Taking the Con Out of Econometrics. But the first thing what Lehmer points out is GDP is seasonal, right? The first quarter is by far the lowest. If you look at, and this just looks at quarterly GDP going back, since World War II. And the reason is obvious because you have the increase in spending going into the holidays and then the spending hangover afterwards. I mean, that's a suitable story for why. I don't really care why. I just know that it's important. So every time you have a weak first quarter, the press is always, here comes the next recession. And the press is your worst guide to understanding the economy and stocks because they are geared towards sensationalism, right? I mean, people have been saying that for 400 years. So a fact-based view, I think, helps more. So you always kind of expect, all things equal, on average, the first quarter is going to be the weakest. So it starts out weak and then gets strong. Interestingly, though, Stocks have the opposite pattern. They kind of start off strong, and I know this is a little hard to take in at once, and they go weak. By the way, the presentation I'm giving is a little different than what you have in your... That's always the case, because I have to give the presentation ahead of time, and the world changes, and, you know, 3 months ago, nobody's interested now what I was talking about then. Maybe that shouldn't be the case. But so stocks start strong, then they get weak and go up. You know, the economy starts weak and gets strong, stocks start strong and go weak. So, I mean, does that make sense? And it does, if you remember the first important lesson I learned as a macroeconomist, and that is that prices lead quantities, right? It makes sense if you think of the stock market as forward-looking. So in general, you know, when the market's going up, the economy's probably going down, but the market's pricing through that. That's what explains the fact that they both have seasonal patterns and they're the complete opposite. But that prices lead quantities. My first boss was a Chicago PhD and an Oxford chemistry PhD. And he used to tell me, you know, prices lead quantities. And quantity data is things like GDP, unemployment, things that are counted. They're backward-looking, they're subject to revision, they're counted with a lag, they're often based on sampling and revised dramatically sometimes. That's quantity data. Price data is forward-looking, things like interest rates, commodity prices, interest rate spreads, and so forth. What I was trained to believe, and I still believe this, but it's heresy to most of the people I talk to, is what my boss told me. Quantity data has no value to you as an investor whatsoever, because by the time it comes out, markets are going to move. Or as the studies show in peer-reviewed journal, any new macroeconomic news gets priced in like 18 seconds. So it's interesting to think about what GDP did last quarter, a year ago, or unemployment. But from the perspective of investments, it's of very little value, and I'll talk about what is. This is the U.S. stock market, so we've got our shock-based view of the world. You can see from market peak to decline, from the 2007-2009 crash, and that we've rebounded completely, right? The stocks are back at, you know, pre-2007 levels. Now, if you look at the news, it's all, you know, wow, it's just been QE and bubble and this and that. So we've got all this negative stuff, Europe, China slowing and so forth, and yet stocks are back at an all-time high, so everything must be completely irrational and unhinged. But let me tell you, on average, if you go back and look at 10% corrections since the 20s or more, this basic chart shows how long on average does it take in months along the horizontal axis to get back to where you started, to get to, for 100% return, where stocks get back to where they started. And on average, it takes 24 months, right? Now, the current rebound in stocks has taken 4 years. So the current rebound's been pretty robust, but it's been taking twice as long as normal. Then if you look at expansions, remember I said the U.S. economy grows at 3% per year. That's an average, so it includes declines and expansions. On expansions alone, the U.S. GDP grows on average about 4%. The average expansion is about 4% per year. The current one is half of that at 2%. And by the way, the last three expansions have been below average. So the way I think about it, and this is a little kitschy, but it might help you, is, you know, half as strong, twice as long. The economy has been growing this rebound half as strong as normal, and the stock market's take is twice as long to rebound. So I don't really see anything out of whack there. This I'd like to talk about a little bit, but we don't really have time, so I'm going to skip it. but what it shows is that if I were to give an award for the research that most accurately explained what we've just gone through in the last 5 years, it's the better work on financial crisis-led recessions, and that comes from McKinsey. Reinhardt Rogoff wrote a book on it, but they included a lot of emerging markets. And the McKinsey Global Institute, they said, look, when you look at developed market recessions caused by financial crisis, they're characterized by the following. Prior to the crash, you have a huge run-up in private sector debt-to-income ratios. Then you have a financial crash and a recession, and then an expansion that's well below normal as the private sector delevers, as the private sector debt-to-income comes down. And then McKinsey said after 4 to 5 years, that deleveraging is complete and the economy shifts back up to its normal growth path. And that's exactly where we are right now. So far, the economy and the expansion and the private sector deleveraging has followed the McKinsey story to a T. So we'll see if we move back up towards a more normal 2.5% to 3% growth path over the next 12 months or so. But it looks like globally things are turning around, and nobody has good global data or can forecast global economy. People look at purchasing managers' indices because they've been kind of the data of choice. You know, the country data is just too stale. And we've seen a deceleration in global growth for 5 years, and it looks like that deceleration might be hitting an inflection point. And that's what the OECD leading indicators show, too. For the first time, they're starting to turn up. So I think that's probably good news. So the last thing before I get into what to look out for, shock-based view of the world. The other thing that economists talk about a lot is monetary and fiscal policy, or the policy mix. And here I'm going to also come across as somewhat of a heretic. Whenever I talk to groups, my boss, Jeannie Wyatt, who founded our firm, will say, Jim, that's interesting, but most of your audience is convinced that the Fed has gone rogue and they've gone on hinge and we're headed for hyperinflation, right? Hyperinflation, I've been reading it in the Wall Street Journal for the last 5 years. What's the Fed concerned about now? Disinflation turning into deflation. So the model's wrong. This is the concern. You know, in a fractional reserve banking system, you know, you deposit $100 in a bank. The bank has to hold a certain percentage on reserve, on average 10 for the system. So $10, and it can loan the rest out, that $90. So you deposit $100 in a bank. The bank holds 10. The other 90 are excess reserves that it can loan out. Now, when the Fed has purchased securities from the banking system to get through this crisis, it has created a tremendous amount of excess in the reserves in the banking system because it's replaced their securities with cash created by the stroke of a pen. That cash, by the way, is still at the Federal Reserve on their balance sheet for the banking system. And this is the excess reserves in the banking system. You can see how dramatic it's increased. But lesson number one is those excess reserves are still there at the Fed. They're not out goosing the stock market or anything. Lesson number two, though, is the concern is that as the economy expands, things normalize, these excess reserves will get loaned out too quickly, and the Fed will lose control or lose its power over the reserves. That'll lead to inflation and expansion of the money supply. But the key paradigm shift was in 2008, the Federal Reserve asked for and received permission to pay interest on reserves, on the excess reserves. I know you guys know this by now, but it made my dissertation obsolete. The Fed had been trying to do this for 15 years so it could control the excess reserves. So if they started to get loaned out too quickly and looked like there was inflation, they could pay interest on it. So a bank wouldn't loan out to a risky project if it could hold the reserves at the Fed risk-free and earn interest, right? Before, the Fed couldn't pay interest on those reserves. So the reserves were costing banks. If banks were holding more than the required amount, then they were foregoing what they could be earning by loaning them. So the Fed, that was a game changer. So I'm much less worried about inflation than the average guy. And by the way, you know, I did go to school at Auburn, and there's a lot of gold bugs there. So I was funded by a group of them, and you know, I went to all the conferences in Jekyll Island and all that good stuff about, you know, what's the government doing to our money. But truth is, monetary policy has been stellar through this crash and through the last 25 years in this country. This is CPI. The light line shows the core rate of inflation, excluding the volatile components of food and energy. And it's been right around the target rate for about 2% through the Asian crisis, through the tech boom and bust, through 9/11, through the Iraq war, through the near collapse of the global financial system. We've had neither inflation nor deflation. That's what the Fed targets as that core rate. The more volatile component is the headline CPI, and that contains food and energy. The reason the Fed doesn't target it is because it is so volatile. It'd be crashing the market all the time. And a lot of people, and I know because I talk to a lot of people, think that the Fed is, you know, nefariously hiding the inflation numbers and inflation's really running rampant and things we actually buy. Well, there's been two private sector initiatives to measure inflation that have far better data than the Fed. And the first is Google. Google hired Hal Varian from Berkeley, the big micro stud that if you went to graduate school, you had to work through his text in micro. And Google comes up, you know, they measure real-time transactions, you know, as they occur instantaneously over what people are buying over time. Their inflation measure matches the cores whenever I've had access to it through things like the National Association of Business Economists. Matches the core really closely. It's a little lower than the core. The other private sector kind of initiative is the MIT's Billion Prices Project. Same kind of idea. And again, their measure, whenever it's been released, is usually a little bit below the Fed's core. So the government's not hiding the inflation numbers. And remember in the 90s, the charge was the opposite, that the government was overstating inflation. I heard this a million times. Overstating inflation increased the COLA adjustments on government contracts. My point is, from this economist's perspective, we don't have a monetary policy problem. It's really on the fiscal side where you have a lot of uncertainty that's been there for, you know, increasing for 10 years and is now starting to come down. So shock number one, people are worried. So what shocks might we worry about over the next 12 months? My first piece of advice is what I'm going to tell you, everybody knows, so it's probably not going to affect markets, but typically in an expansion, housing and autos, and really housing leads the expansion. This one was unique in that housing was on its back the whole time. Fortunately, exports and business spending was stronger than average coming out of this recession. So it kind of took up the slack. And then when exports and business invested spending started to slow, housing started to pick up. So it was a pretty good combination. But this is also from Lehmer's book. These are the components of quarterly GDP. And he asks, what predictive power does GDP and the components have? Housing, by far, residential construction, is the strongest predictive variable for next quarter's GDP. So housing, you know, explains about 30% of the change in GDP. So housing is the most important predictive variable. What is GDP itself? It explains about 14. So last quarter's GDP number explains about 14% of next quarter's GDP growth number, right? So GDP has no predictive power. So when you hear, wow, GDP was refined downward last quarter, you should say, so what? It doesn't mean anything. All right. According to the guru of econometrics, GDP's one quarter's GDP doesn't really mean anything for the next quarter's GDP. This is on the left, mortgage rates, and on the right, housing loan apps. And I'm just going to tell you, I know that this is hard to see, but you know, it's no big surprise when mortgage rates go up, loan apps go down. Okay, when mortgage rates go up a lot, loan apps go down a lot. So that is a concern. But here's the magic diagram, I think, from an old colleague of mine at Credit Suisse recently. Housing affordability indices are still at or near all-time highs. You know, the prices of houses, including mortgage rates, relative to income. And what this shows you, that line to the right, how far, you know, what the impact would be of 100 basis points, say, increase in mortgage rates on the housing affordability indices. So if mortgage rates increase another 100 bips, it bring the affordability indices right in line with their long-term average. So, and we don't really expect another surge in interest rates, not that anybody can predict interest rates. I mean, if you think you're smarter than the global bond market, I know I'm not. I'll just leave it at that. But you know, the term premium that the Fed had brought down by purchasing securities completely reversed. So the entire impact on intermediate-term interest rates from the Fed had reversed itself earlier in the summer. We think that was more of a one-time shift than, you know, a huge bond rout, but we'll see. But that would be how to think about the impact of mortgage rates, interest rates and mortgage rates on housing, and housing's important. So that's shock number one. Right now, we don't really see that as significant enough to cause a recession. And also, if and when the Fed does taper, it's not going to start with mortgage-backed securities. I can almost guarantee that. By the way, this idea that the Fed is monetizing the debt and you know, we're the next Weimar Republic. Federal holding of treasuries relative to treasuries outstanding is still pretty low relative to what it was even in the 70s. So it's nothing. No economist likes to see the central bank buying securities and so forth. But, you know, it's not as drastic as a lot of people think. The second big shock would be a war, right? Syria would be a good example. And here, you know, I'm back to prices lead quantities. I much prefer a market price than an economist. And, you know, when I'm thinking about, you know, going into a large-scale war, I use the price of oil as my guide of how likely that is. Not that it's perfect, but it's better than anything else I know. And going into the Desert Storm 1990, oil went up about over 50% in the 3 to 4 months prior to the invasion. Same thing in Iraq, the middle panel, you know, up about 55%. I don't really see that here with Brent, the international crude. So right now, the price of oil, now you can argue that, well, oil would probably be $80 a barrel if it wasn't for Mideast strife. That might be so, but typically you have a big run up 50% or more before major invasion. So right now, the price of oil is telling me that's probably not likely. And the other thing I'll tell you about war, all I know about war and investments, and I'm trying to share with you what I think would you know, you might benefit the most, at least from my experience. Following 9/11, I was involved in a big research project to see how wars impacted asset classes. And the one pattern we found that was striking, there was two themes. The first one was that when you have a war or a threat of a big war, people immediately move to the big global companies, the investors do, because they have diversified cash flow streams in all the major markets of the world, right? And that kind of makes sense. The other view, though, says, you know, wealth is created by production and exchange, and anything that threatens the global web of exchange threatens those global big global companies the most, because plants and equipment and employees that make sense in a global economy become redundant in a more localized economy. So that suggests the opposite. Avoid those big globally exposed firms. So what did the data show? And what we did is we looked 3 months after 9/11 and then a full 12 months after. And we broke it up into firms that had no international exposure, no international sales, some international sales, a lot of international sales, and in the bottom, which I won't get into, is really, really, you know, not only were they a lot of international sales, but including the companies that sold to them. And the pattern was distinct. Immediately following 9/11, the more international sales you had, the better you did, right, for 3 months. And then over the next 9 months, it was a total flip-flop. The more international sales you had, the less you did. So our conclusion was that immediately there's that flight to safety in the big established global firms. But as the logic of a prolonged war kind of started to spell itself out, people started moving more towards the domestic firms that didn't rely on a big global growing web of exchange for growth. So that's the only thing we learned that I think was worthwhile. So basically, for an oil shock to create a recession, I'm here to tell you economists don't know how big a price of oil would take increase in order to cause a recession. Back in the 2000s, all commodities, oil, gold, you name it, all went up in 2002 when China joined the World Trade Organization. And at that time, the consensus of economists with the Wall Street Journal, all with their proprietary models, said that if oil stays above $50 a barrel, we'll have a recession in the next 12 months. Okay, well, it didn't happen. We had 5 years of expansion. We didn't have a recession until oil hit 150, and that's not what caused it. It was a collapse of the global financial system. So having said that, every big recession we've had has been preceded by a doubling in the price of oil, and we haven't seen that yet. So an oil shock in a war, I think, is another thing to be concerned about, but I'm not seeing it in the data right now, the things that are forward-looking. And, you know, a lot of my relatives, you know, they are a big believer in Eisenhower's military-industrial complex causing wars because of defense companies that profit from them. And I'll echo George Stigler on that. As an economist, I'll give you an economist's opinion. There's no doubt that companies profit from war just like they profit from everything else. Poverty programs, foreign aid programs, financial crises. But Stigler used to say, it's implausible to imagine, for every company that benefits from war, there's at least 10 as big or bigger that suffer greatly because of it. And Stigler used to say, it's implausible to assume that companies that benefit from war spend their money lobbying Congress to do that. And those that suffer greatly don't spend a dime or spend any effort lobbying Congress and the opposite. Just something to think about on that, because, I mean, I hear it at every cocktail party I'm at. And I've got a lot of military people in my family. I myself am ex-Coast Guard. So the third shock, so I don't see, oil is a big concern, oil price shock or war, but I don't really see those in the data yet. The third one would be slowing China. Now, the emerging market story is one that was and still is the story of our lifetimes. But they have slowed. But that's old news. And this is the forecast for global GDP from the IMF for the major regions for 2013 and 2014. The IMF doesn't know what growth is going to be, but they have the best data, right? They have access to country data that nobody else has. Some of it's released, some of it's not. But I will tell you this. So proprietary research, Wall Street Research, I think has a better forecasting record than the IMF. And where they are most at odds with the IMF's outlook here, and the IMF's outlook is that, you know, U.S., the momentum should start turning positive, 3.1% global growth for this year, you know, maybe 3.8% for next, is China. That's where most of the Wall Street researchers say, you know, I think that's too bullish. And you hear a lot of people, this is from McKinsey Global, saying, you know, you've never really had an economy like China's growing that fast for that long without a big slowdown that surprised even the pessimists. He says, I think it's be hard to find good reasons to think China will be an exception. Now, the problem with China is that I can find similar statements from equally credible sources going back 15 years. You know, when I was living in Chicago, I think it was 06, I heard a speech from Austin Goolsbee, who ended up being an advisor to the president for a while. And he was at University of Chicago, and he said, I'm going to give you five predictions over the next 12 months. One of them is China's going to collapse because the banking system is going to collapse. Okay, so I've been hearing, and everybody has for a long time, but we think that for a lot of reasons, including official policy now in China, it's time to take the slower China growth a little more seriously longer term. And that doesn't mean that the emerging market story is going away. That is the story of our lifetimes, the growth of the emerging market consumer, whether it's India, China, Latin America, so forth. This is a very conservative estimate of more. And you guys know the story. I mean, you know, emerging markets, when you have, you know, when your income reaches $1,500 a year, you know, you want indoor plumbing, and, you know, another $2,500, you want a cell phone, $5,000, you know, flat screen TV, $10,000 a car. So the increase in consumption is huge. And conservative estimates for China alone over the next 10 years are that the upper middle class and affluent will increase by 100 million people. Now, by comparison, the baby boom generation post-World War II that supposedly drove the U.S. economy was 79 billion. So that's a big chunk. The impact, though, of a slowing China will be, I mentioned that commodities boom that took place when China joined the World Trade Organization. Most people think that that's pretty much over, right? We're not going to have it, you know, and you're not going to see these models allocating as much to commodities like you did towards the end of that boom. McKinsey's argument is that the price of commodities will drop sharply, perhaps 50% over the next 10 years. Now, nobody knows the number, but I think the direction's right. I think down rather than up. There's a lot of implications. Most of the analysts I see think the best play in the slowing China is Mexico. And we're already seeing that. I spend a lot of time, I have clients in El Paso and Laredo, and I spend a lot of time along, not any more than I have to, but on the border. I think you'll know what I mean if you go down there. It's still a little scary. But companies are coming back in. The maquiladoras are firing back up. And cheap natural gas facilitates manufacturing and assembly. So Mexico seems to be the obvious play in a slowing China, one of the obvious ones. The other one is consumer goods companies. And this is the way we play it at my firm. Our view is that people in emerging markets, they want, what do they want? They want toothpaste and antibiotics like the rest of us, right? So consumer goods, healthcare stocks, those that are tapped into emerging markets, those are good plays long term over the next 10 years. So there's no reason to get into a trading mentality. The final thing is Europe, right? And, you know, people have been talking about Europe breaking up for the last 5 years. But I'm here to tell you that if you look at the tangible actions of the European Union, they've all been in the exact, and the members, in the exact opposite direction. They've all been towards keeping the union intact and maintaining the euro. And the European Union project has been an ongoing thing for 100 years, right? I mean, Winston Churchill talked about, you know, it's time for a United States of Europe. But it gets dislocated a lot. But here again, rather than an economist, I'd prefer market prices. And during the big financial crisis, 2007-09, an entire industry was created on global risk measures. Things like the TED spread, the Treasury Eurodollar spread, or the LIBOR OIS, all of which measure the short-term stress or confidence in overnight loans of the major global banks. The Federal Reserve took the best of St. Louis, took the best of these. They're all price data, whether it's LIBOR, TED spread, options data from the stock market, you know, emerging market debt yields, combined them all in one big measure called Financial Stress Index. And this is what it looks like. And you go to Financial St. Louis Fed, FRED, which is the name of their database. You can pull off enough data there in 5 minutes that I used to make a living selling, you know, 15 years ago or 18 years ago. But this is the stress index. You can see the recession, the gray area. You can see where it was when the world almost collapsed. And you can see how much financial stress has come down. We've had these little hiccups because mostly of European headline risk and real risk. But basically, financial stress is nowhere. Right now, the index is saying whatever problems there might be in Europe, they're not a threat to the whole global financial system or systemic risk, right? And this is what I look at. So I would forget an economist's opinion of Europe. Look at the Global Financial Stress Index. And it's not leading. You can't make money trading on it, I don't think. But it'll give you a sense. You know, wow, are things getting scary? Let's look at the Financial Stress Index. Yeah, it's up a little bit, but it's still not at, you know, collapse range. The other thing I look at in this, continuing the idea that prices, you know, lead quantities and it's price data you want to watch, is the price of the euro in terms of dollars. And, you know, the Nobel Prize winner who's called the father of the euro was a guy named Robert Mundell. He advises the European Central Bank and the Chinese Central Bank, frankly. Mundell said that the biggest threat, and Mundell's always said there's a handful of usually American economists that argue that the euro was doomed from the start, it was a bad experiment, the fiscal side wasn't fixed, and, you know, it's headed for failure. And Mundell said, you know, actually, and he, you know, he's the guru on it, he said, actually the opposite's true. Within 3 years, the euro was the second most widely used currency in the world, in the modern world. It was the most successful currency introduction in history, and it remains there today. And he said the biggest threat to Europe is the euro that's too strong. And he said the biggest threat to the U.S. is the dollar that's too strong. And he said the biggest threat to the global economy is either a euro too strong tanking Europe or a dollar too strong tanking the United States. So he said what you'd really want to see is a euro somewhere between $1.25 and $1.35. And he said, you know, when the euro strengthens above $1.35, it'd be nice if the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve intervened to kind of bring it down. And when the euro fell below a dollar, when the dollar strengthened, the euro fell below $1.25, the opposite. And I always say that when Mundell talks, policymakers listen within 12 to 18 months. And since he made that statement, we've kind of moved into a pennant right in that range that he's talking about. In dollars per euro, you know, right somewhere between, you know, right there around 130-ish. So that's good. That's a price I watch is the euro. So I watch the St. Louis Financial Stress Index and the price of the euro in terms of dollars. That's what I watch for Europe. Certainly not the headlines. And by the way, on the dollar, one more thing just to kind of castigate my former colleagues. I hear a lot. And again, a lot of this comes from the key family get-togethers more than anything else. Is, you know, it's the what has the government done to our money thing, and, you know, the dollar's going down the toilet. You can see during the financial crisis, this is the value of the dollar versus other currencies. And I know you've been told this, but obviously the opposite. You remember going into the crash, China was going to ditch dollars, and, you know, and the dollar was going to collapse. And obviously the opposite. They ditched everything but dollars and dollar-denominated deposits. And every time we've had a scare since, it's the same thing. So the dollar remains the safe haven. But this is the dollar going back from the 70s on. You can see it's kind of those two big round trips were driven by real rates of return between the U.S. and the rest of the world. I could prove the second one with data, but we don't have time. But here's the way to think about the dollar from my perspective. The U.S. back in the 70s was about half of global GDP, right? Total output of goods and services, the U.S. was half. Now the U.S. is less than a third, and that's the U.S. has continued to grow, but the rest of the world's kind of got on board, right? As Tony Blair would say, you know, China grew because they became more like us and probably will continue to do so. Same with India, same with all. So as the U.S. has gone from about half of the world's GDP to less than a third, the dollar's fallen by a similar amount relative to the world's trading currency, which makes sense, right? So that's what I see about the dollar. And finally, last slide. So what is that looking ahead? Those are the big shocks I see that might disrupt things. Housing, oil, China, Europe. Right now, I don't see anything in the data that tells me we've had or will have a shock that will create a recession in the next 12 months. As far as you've all heard about all the money on the sidelines, that's been the case for a long time. We're starting to see for the first time the black line is money flowing out of funds into bonds. The gray is stocks. And for the first time, if you look at the far right, we're finally starting to see positive flows into equities, and the flows into bonds are starting to dry up. So I'm not going to call it the great rotation. The press is always, it's either, you know, full on, full off, but the world is usually somewhere in the middle. But I do think we're starting to, well, I don't think, we are starting to see that. So with that, I don't know where I am on time. That's a wall of words, but I'd be glad to answer, it looks like we got about 5 minutes or so. Any questions? I think the best thing to have an economist is just to throw questions at him and throw his opinion against, five economists, five opinions, right? Does anybody have any questions? Yes? No? None. Okay, that must mean that it's enough of that. All right.